SBS World View.
And it's a good morning. It's 6 o'clock across Australia. Welcome to Worldview Breakfast with Adam Connors. Coming up this hour, China regarded as the key player in the nuclear standoff with North Korea. Also, lives in jeopardy, the federal government stands accused, and a Nepalese love story down under. These stories and more are coming up after a bulletin of the latest world news.
Good morning, I'm Nikki Kenning. NATO has assumed command of the eastern provinces of Afghanistan. The region's been under the control of US military commanders since the overthrow of the Taliban 5 years ago. About 12,000 US troops will now come under the British commander, Lieutenant General David Richards. NATO Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer says the move will break the Taliban's strength in the eastern region.
NATO brings in twice the force the coalition had in the area. And nobody, be it Taliban, be it drugs lord, will appreciate very much if he sees forces coming in and chasing him out and reprieving him of his very lucrative whatever activity he might be engaged in.
Australia says Papua New Guinean authorities should arrest Australian lawyer Julian Moti, who's wanted in Australia on a child sex charge. Mr. Moti, who's been appointed to the Solomon Islands Attorney General, is sheltering in the Solomon's High Commission in PNG to avoid extradition to Australia. PNG's Prime Minister, Michael Somare, says he does not believe PNG authorities have any obligation to arrest Mr. Moti. But Australia's Justice Minister, Chris Ellison, has told the ABC he disagrees.
I'm at a loss to understand why he says that. We have firm legal advice from the Attorney General's Department that we've followed due process. And in fact, you have to remember that Mr. Moti was taken before a court in Port Moresby. He then failed to appear, breached his bail, and the court in New Guinea issued a warrant for his arrest.
The Democrats have condemned the federal government's stated intention to appeal a federal court decision granting native title over about 6,000 square kilometres of metropolitan Perth and its surrounds. The West Australian government's already announced it's seeking an appeal. Federal Attorney General Philip Ruddock claims the federal court's decision could mean that people who aren't the traditional owners could be denied access to public open spaces, including parks and beaches. But the Deputy Leader of the Democrats, Andrew Bartlett, has described the comments as scaremongering.
Any number of people have said that the Attorney General is simply wrong at law. It just tries to divide the community, and we've seen now enough examples of how native title works to know that it doesn't remove rights for the non-Indigenous communities. In fact, the real disappointment of native title is for Indigenous people and how little directly it provides for them.
The Parliamentary Secretary for Immigration, Andrew Robb, says the introduction of a formal citizenship test won't result in fewer employment opportunities for people with poor English language skills. The government last month released a discussion paper on the proposed test, which includes a test of English language skills. Ethnic and community groups are critical of the proposal, saying it goes against multicultural policies. However, Mr. Robb says acquiring English language skills will not be part of the criteria for getting a job in Australia.
But it will be a prerequisite for citizenship. When people have been here for 4 years, they will then qualify to apply for citizenship. And it is our expectation that if people are going to make that big step of committing themselves to the Australian way of life, that they would want to know that they've got a functional level of English so that they can be part of the community and that they can meet the responsibilities that come with citizenship.
The United States negotiator to stalled six-party talks with North Korea has warned against any nuclear test. North Korea says it plans to test a nuclear device at an unspecified date in response to what it describes as a threat of nuclear war and sanctions from the US. Negotiator Christopher Hill has told CNN the US opposes North Korea's desire to be a nuclear rival.
If you look back to 1960 or 1970, North Korea was actually ahead of South Korea. So imagine what the North Korean leadership now feels when they look at South Korea, the world's 11th largest industrial country. And it seems that they think that weapons of mass destruction will somehow increase their prestige. It'll somehow make them into a member of an exclusive club. And what we need to make very clear to them, we're simply not going to accept them as a nuclear country.
A critically wounded schoolgirl injured in Monday's shooting at an Amish school in the United States has been taken off life support and taken home to die. Five girls were killed when Charles Roberts besieged their school, lined them up and shot them before turning the gun on himself. The Amish community of Nickel Mines has held funerals for four of the victims and the fifth will be buried tomorrow. German drugs maker Schering has warned consumers not to use hemorrhoid cream on their faces. The announcement follows revelations by a male stylist on Norwegian television that many models use the cream in the morning to get rid of puffy eyes. Schering says the comments have boosted demand for their product, but they've warned the product is a pharmaceutical, not a cosmetic. And now a look at the weather. Fine, mostly sunny days expected for all the major cities around the country today. Hobart's expecting a top of 18, Melbourne 20, Adelaide 22, Perth 24, Darwin 35, Brisbane a top of 27. Newcastle and Sydney will see lengthy sunny periods, 22, Wollongong 21, Canberra 22 the maximum. And that's SBS News.
Thanks, Nikki. That's Nikki Canning in the SBS Radio newsroom. On SBS Radio around the country, this is Worldview with Adam Connors. It's 6 minutes past six. The United States is finding that it has very little bargaining power left, even through the United Nations, to try and rein in North Korea's threats to test nuclear weapons. As our US correspondent Mike Kellerman reports, the best route to Pyongyang continues to be through China.
Well, the US says it sees the announcement to test a nuclear weapon as a provocation, is the word they used. The Americans are beginning to put the pressure on North Korea through China. And in fact, Secretary Rice has had meetings over the last couple of days with various and sundry diplomats trying to urge China to urge Pyongyang not to do this. At a think tank, the special envoy for North Korea from the United States, Mr. Christopher Hill, spoke about the crisis and said that the answer is for the North Koreans to go back to the six-party talks and honor the agreement that they signed back in September, which offered a package of incentives from the United States if North Korea would stop developing nuclear weapons.
We've called on the DPRK to desist from these threats, to return to the talks without preconditions, to honor the commitments that it made in the September 19th statement, because we have told them on many occasions, we've told them publicly, we've told them privately, that we will implement all of our undertakings right down to every sentence in the agreement.
Well, wasn't the North Korean announcement attributed directly towards various threats by the United States and in response to their feelings of insecurity?
They're constantly fearful of an invasion by the U.S., but the Bush administration says repeatedly it has no plans to do that, although it has stationed a portion of its military in the Pacific Ocean near the Korean coast. This is an ongoing, of course, crisis. Months and months and months of talks have gotten nowhere. At the United Nations, the UN Security Council had a meeting on this subject and is expected to prepare and issue a condemnatory statement. U.S. Ambassador John Bolton spoke after the meeting, as did Kenjo Oshima, who's the Japanese UN ambassador and now the temporary president of the Security Council.
There was a very strong concern expressed by the intention to conduct a nuclear test. And everybody who spoke against, of course, a nuclear test of that country, and strongly urged North Korea to desist from it.
Other than hard words against North Korea over testing, what's going to happen going forward? What else does the United Nations have up its sleeve to slow down or stop any sort of testing of these weapons?
Well, the UN doesn't really have a lot of options, and neither does the Bush administration. But, you know, the North Koreans are so isolated diplomatically and in other aspects. Financial transactions that they try to conduct through international banks are oftentimes blocked because of action by the United States and the UN. there's only so many sanctions left that one can impose. So the answer to your question, I think, is very little.
What can the Chinese bring to bear?
Well, the Chinese have a lot of influence with Pyongyang. They have managed to shepherd the six-party talks for quite some time, although, of course, they have broken off. The Chinese are a regional power, and the Chinese have the leverage to perhaps convince Pyongyang that conducting a nuclear test would be not worth the negative reverberations around the world.
Speaking of other partnerships, Bob Woodward's book, State of Denial, seems to be having continuing repercussions for the Bush presidency, including how U.S. intelligence allegedly held back vital information from its so-called war on terror partners.
Well, you know, Adam, I recall a couple years ago when President Bush referred to Australia as the deputy sheriff for the United States in the war on terror in the region. And it appears, though, that if Woodward's book is correct, that the sheriff was left out of the loop when it came to critical intelligence from the feuding U.S. intelligence agencies regarding the war on terror and other matters. The Brits were also apparently left out of the loop. This is quite embarrassing for the Bush administration, simply because both the British and, of course, the Australians are America's key allies in this war against terror. Part of the book has not been confirmed by the Bush administration, and there are other parts that the Bush administration has denied actually took place.
The Republican leadership is being grilled over whether or not it knew about allegations of Congressman Mark Foley's explicit advances to underage interns.
Yeah, this scandal is having more than just an impact as far as a shock value because of a congressman who was on a committee that was supposedly protecting exploited children and turns out to be a pedophile himself, and emailed young high school pages who frequent Congress as part of an internship program. And he, of course, resigned in disgrace, claims now that it was alcoholism that caused him to be a pedophile. People are just shaking their heads. The White House says it's disgusted. In addition, now the question is, did the Republican leadership sit on the information about the salacious emails that Mr. Foley sent to young male pages in order to protect his Republican seat in Florida? At the White House, the spokesman, Tony Snow, was just shaking his head and saying, look, we've just got to find out what the facts are first.
This is an awful and disturbing story. We need to find out what it is that people knew. The question is, what exactly did they have? And the speaker has turned over emails and documents to the Justice Department, which they are reviewing. And if there are legal steps, one presumes that the proper and duly constituted legal authorities will follow through on them.
And Laura Bush has unexpectedly been deployed to help the Republicans following Congressman Foley's issue.
Well, Adam, the midterm elections in which the pollsters say the Democrats might recapture control of the House of Representatives and may even recapture control of the U.S. Senate because of voter discontent with the Bush policies, that election is now only 4 weeks off. The Republicans are quite frankly worried that they're going to lose control of the Congress, and so even Mrs. Bush was sent out on the hustings to campaign for the Republicans. She was in New York, Western New York, campaigning on behalf of Congressman Tom Reynolds, who's a Republican whose seat is in jeopardy because Mr. Reynolds may be somehow swept up into the Foley scandal because he apparently or allegedly did not inform Republican leadership that he knew information that this man was attempting to solicit young men.
America faces challenges too important to be reduced to just politics. Ending our dependence on foreign oil, reforming our immigration system, rebuilding the Gulf Coast, and keeping our country safe from terrorism are not easy tasks, but they're absolutely vital goals. To accomplish them, we must have serious national conversations conducted with civility and respect.
Mrs. Bush laid out an agenda. She's campaigning for her husband. It shows, I think, that the Republicans are close to desperate now that they have to send out the president's wife to campaign to raise money for Republican candidates.
Our U.S. correspondent Mike Kellerman on the Republican Party's woes leading into the midterm elections. With the North Korean crisis escalating, the new Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, is facing a baptism of fire. As our Japan correspondent Jeff Shaw reports, the newly elected Prime Minister finds himself thrust into international dialogue with China, South Korea, and a possible new nuclear weapons power just off the coast in North Korea.
Well, Japan has strongly, of course, condemned the North for pledging to carry out this nuclear test, saying that it would never forgive the action if they did carry it out. We've also seen Japanese and US security advisers agreeing to seek a statement from the United Nations Security Council president to discourage North Korea from carrying out this test. However, the UN Security Council has failed to agree a response, which has further sparked concern. Apparently, the 15 council members have expressed concern about North Korea, but have decided to let experts work on a strategic response. And this all comes as a bit of a surprise to Japan. If you remember, back in July, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted the resolution following their test firing earlier that month of ballistic missiles, which fell into the Sea of Japan. So Japan is very much unhappy and very concerned over this latest announcement by the North.
There is quite a lot of saber-rattling that happens in the region, especially with North Korea and Japan. Is Japan taking this threat seriously of weapons testing?
Well, if there's any country that's used to the back-and-forth and somewhat unpredictable nature of Pyongyang, Japan is one of the countries. In the past, Japan, as I mentioned, has dealt with its fair share of false warnings and actual true warnings as well. So along with the false warnings, it wouldn't be surprising to see the government here just shake this one off. However, officials did take the statement seriously, saying that they no doubt believe North Korea's resolve in testing its nuclear device. And just in June this year, U.S. Private Research Institute released a report that estimated that North Korea has produced enough plutonium for anywhere from 4 to 13 atomic bombs. So it has been taken very seriously by the government of Japan this time round.
North Korea and their testing, as well as possibly the strengthening of the self-defense force, will be on the agenda, I'm sure, at the summit talks coming up this weekend.
Of course, that will be one of the major topics on the list this Sunday. The new Prime Minister Abe will be meeting with Chinese President Hu Jintao, and then the following day, holding talks with South Korean President. There'll be a lot of things on the agenda. One of them will be the repeated visits to the Yasukuni Shrine. Japan-China talks have not been held since April in 2005 due to China's opposition to former Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi's repeated visits to the shrine where war criminals are enshrined. So this summit meeting is a real positive first major step for the new Prime Minister and something that the public hope to see more of, basically better relations with Asian neighbours and a more open dialogue between the countries.
Our Japan correspondent Jeff Shaw on the immediate challenges facing Japan's new Prime Minister. The time here on Worldview across the country on SBS Radio is 17 minutes past 6. And still to come, one couple's love of life in Australia tinged with concern for their homeland.
Sometimes I do think people like us should actually go back and, you know, maybe that would make a lot of difference, like going back and helping, you know, all the other unfortunate people out there.
The personal story of a young Nepalese couple who fell in love in Australia, that's a little later on Worldview. A refugee advocacy centre claims the federal government has jeopardised the lives of hundreds of asylum seekers by telling them it was safe to return home, only for them to face renewed persecution. Greg Dyett reports.
In a new report, the Catholic-run Edmund Rice Centre says it followed the cases of 41 deported asylum seekers, many of whom were ethnic Hazaras from Afghanistan, and found that 39 were sent back to life-threatening situations. The centre also released a similar report in August in which it claimed 9 Afghan asylum seekers were killed after they returned to their homeland after accepting repatriation packages from the Australian government in 2002. The Immigration Minister, Amanda Vanstone, says the Edmund Rice Centre has been unable to provide sufficient evidence to back up its claims. But the centre's director, Phil Glendenning, says the report is based on interview material gathered by respected academics, human rights groups and church organisations. He says the report highlights what he describes as some basic flaws in the government's immigration policies.
Well, I think moving people offshore where they're away from the reach of Australian law, but they don't have the protection of Australian law and where wrong decisions can be made, seriously needs to be re-evaluated. The information that people base their decisions on, sending people back to places like Sri Lanka and Colombia and Afghanistan, are seriously flawed. That whole process needs to be looked at.
Senator Vanstone says her department will investigate the claims raised by the Edmund Rice Centre if it's prepared to provide more information. But Phil Glendenning says providing specific names of some asylum seekers could further jeopardise their safety, especially in countries like Afghanistan, where they could be targeted by militia groups. He says the Australian government assured hundreds of Afghans that they'd be safe if they were sent home, but this wasn't the case.
They got back and found that as refugees who'd sought asylum outside the country, they were targeted by local militia groups, in particularly in the Taliban regions of Afghanistan, and so have consequently had to flee. Only one of the Hazaras now lives in Afghanistan. It is true they were promised help with housing, help with accommodation, help with jobs. None of that was true. Some got 3 days accommodation in the Mustafa Hotel, but that was it.
The Edmund Rice Centre's report also raises cases of alleged persecution of asylum seekers deported back to countries such as Iran, Iraq, Sri Lanka and Colombia. It says many asylum seekers are unfairly deported because they lack basic legal rights to defend themselves under the federal government's current immigration policies. Labor's immigration spokesman Tony Burke says this is particularly true under the so-called Pacific Solution, where asylum seekers are processed at the Australian Detention Centre in Nauru.
The cost of getting a refugee decision wrong is you do deport people to danger. One of the features of many of the people who are assessed who'd fled Afghanistan is that in very large numbers they were processed in Nauru. That meant they were processed without the checks and balances of the Australian legal system. We're much more likely to get decisions wrong when we take away true judicial processes.
Phil Glendenning says the centre will present its findings to federal coalition backbenchers in an effort to change the existing policies.
And that story was compiled by Michael Kenny of SBS News. On Worldview, it's 21 minutes past six.
Since the article was published, there is no more any secrets. All the secrets was published is in the hand of all the world. All the leaders should speak about Israel nuclear secrets.
20 years ago this week, a single man exposed Israel's top-secret nuclear facility where the nation had allegedly been developing nuclear weapons. Mordecai Vanunu's disclosure suggested Israel had joined the five other countries that have been developing nuclear weapons: the United States, Russia, China, Britain and France. So what relevance do those events in Israel in 1986 have for the contemporary debate about nuclear proliferation?
Every decent Israeli hates Vanunu. He's a born traitor. He betrayed his church, he betrayed his synagogue, he betrayed his nation, he betrayed his country, he betrayed his working place, he betrayed his colleagues. There are people for whom betrayal seems to be second nature.
He embodies the contradiction in American foreign policy. Morty's revelations that there are more weapons of mass destruction in Israel and the rest of the Middle East put together is an embarrassing revelation for this country and for the US.
Looking back, if you could turn the clock back to 1986, would you have done what you did? Or
absolutely, absolutely, because what I did is to inform the world what is going on in secret. I didn't come and say we should destroy Israel or should destroy Dimona. I said, look what they have and make your judgment. My view is you should not have this stuff, these nuclear weapons.
The revelations and incarceration of Mordecai Vanunu in 1986, following his allegations of Israel's secret nuclear arsenal, unveiled what many believe is the world's sixth nuclear weapons power. 20 years later, we have a seventh and an eighth in India and Pakistan. And there are undoubtedly more to follow, with North Korea tipped to test one, and though they're an early signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran is on the verge of having the technology, if not the will. But back then, to the horror of all, except for the US financiers and the French and British technology partners, Israel's weapons arsenal was exposed by a former worker at its Dimona nuclear research facility. The nuclear whistleblower was Mordecai Vanunu, and he was to spend the next 18 years in jail. Upon his release in 2004, he reiterated again the reasons why he exposed the nuclear weapons arsenal, and his words today continue to challenge all nations to think again about nuclear proliferation.
To all those who are calling me traitor, I am saying I am proud and happy to do what I did. I am very glad that I succeed to do what I did. I will continue to speak against all kinds of nuclear weapons. I want the President of the United States, George Bush, and Tony Blair, and Gerhard Schröder, Vladimir Putin, all the leaders should speak about Israel nuclear secrets. Time come to end this silence and secret cooperation by the West.
Israel is not a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, which monitors the flow of uranium within and between nuclear states. Neither is Pakistan or India. So in 2006, when the United States and Australia speak of the new uranium market in India, how does this place the NPT and nuclear safeguards? Australia's Foreign Minister Alexander Downer says the government is investigating a homegrown uranium enrichment program.
Australia obviously is a very stable country politically. Australia has 40% or so of the world's exploitable uranium reserves, and Australia has been a long-standing and strong leader in the non-proliferation movement. So looking at it on that basis, it would be preferable for enriched uranium to come from countries like Australia and maybe some others which you might politely describe as less stable.
Well, I think that's remarkably condescending.
Professor Richard Bronowski is a former ambassador to Vietnam, South Korea, Mexico and many others. His book Fact or Fission, The Truth About Australia's Nuclear Ambitions, explores this and many other angles of these issues.
He's not game to say which those countries that are not responsible are, and he misses a fact about the Howard government's own record, signing on to the National Missile Defense Program and Theater Missile Defense Programs of the United States, both of which are very strong pressure points for proliferation in our region. That's hardly a responsible thing for the Howard government to do. Saying that we will enrich uranium in Australia and not giving any indication of whether this meant under a leasing arrangement or not is highly irresponsible. And also being very selective and uncritical of the United States' continuing program to develop its own nuclear weapons and not criticise that is also highly irresponsible. I think Mr Downer, quite frankly, has very strong double standards.
Leslie Kemeny is Australia's member of the International Nuclear Energy Academy and has taught in nuclear engineering throughout the world. He is pro-nuclear and believes Australia can roll out an airtight nuclear leasing program.
I believe that the demand for energy and the demand for a clean environment and a reduction, perhaps even the eventual elimination of climate change due to carbon dioxide is so strong. Most countries are now voting very much pro-nuclear, and I think Australia will follow.
How could Australia, with its talk now of its export of uranium, how can it safeguard its uranium from cradle to grave, from being used in domestic energy supply compared to nuclear arsenal building?
The world recognises that Australia, with its major uranium resource, which seems to be increasing almost by the month, and we are only speaking of top-grade, easily recoverable or relatively cheaply recoverable resources, can play a big part in non-proliferation. It has obeyed, it has been compliant, and it's a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I would personally, this is a personal opinion, when I came back from Britain in the late 60s, I saw the technological possibility of Australia playing a huge part in non-proliferation by being fully involved in the full nuclear fuel cycle. That is, by not just exporting U-308, yellow cake, to various countries and seeing those countries go to other countries for enrichment and fuel element manufacture in many cases. And on the rear end of the cycle, potentially two countries reprocess nuclear fuel. If Australia offered the world this whole nuclear industry, it would certainly play a huge part in ensuring non-proliferation. I think few Australians realise that every country north of us, and we're not now just speaking of India and China, but Indonesia has a firm nuclear power program. They would like to see their first peaceful nuclear power station online by about 2016, commencing in around about 2010. Vietnam is in that position. Malaysia is in a similar position. If we became a reliable source of fuel for all our neighbours, then the more we became involved in enrichment and potentially in taking the spent, the irradiated nuclear fuel, either disposing of it in our country, which has the best geology for it, probably the best geology in the world, or reprocessing, then we could be doing the world a great service in three areas: in energy supply, in greenhouse gas reduction, and in non-proliferation.
Howard talks about joining the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership of George W. Bush. That in itself is a transgression of the NPT, because it's saying countries that should have the right to develop any kind of civil nuclear technology, including enrichment and reprocessing, are now not allowed to do so. So it's a double standard by the United States. They're trying to impose their will on the world, and many countries who are not nuclear weapon states but see some attraction in developing them find this completely unacceptable, and Iran is one of them.
But as time goes by, if India were to meet safeguard obligations, some Australians would see it as anomalous if we would sell uranium to China but not to India. But at the moment, it would be against policy, and there would need to be good reasons to change that policy, but the issue is obviously under consideration.
I think I'd prefer to draw a parallel between the case of Israel, if I may, and Iran. If Ahmadinejad and the Iranians get a nuclear weapon, it would be regarded as an intolerable situation. My view, though, is that Iran is developing, has exactly the same motivation for developing nuclear weapons as Israel, that is, as a deterrent against attack from outsiders.
Isn't it some double standards that Iran has been part of the non-proliferation treaty for 36 years?
Yes, it is a double standard. Israel is not a signatory to the NPT. Neither is India or Pakistan. Iran is, and this shows the weakness of the treaty, because there's no way in which, if a country wishes to develop nuclear weapons and remain, it can remain a signatory, and it won't be found out until it's ready to say, there you are, we've got weapons and we're going to walk away from the treaty.
When could the NPT just be dissolved and everyone just walks away from it?
Adam, I'm optimistic about this. I don't think it will be... It's like saying, when does a nation state collapse, you know? I don't think the NPT necessarily will collapse. And quite frankly, I think we have a government that claims to be enormously responsible about nuclear weapons and technology and the export of our uranium. The best thing this government could do would be to say, yes, we have one-third of the proven, economically recoverable uranium resources in the world. We are going to use that as a lever, a diplomatic lever, to begin a process to review the whole nuclear non-proliferation regime. And that would be something that Australia could do, and it would restore, quite frankly, the status that we once did have when Gareth Evans was Foreign Minister, of being a responsible international citizen. It would be wonderful to see such an initiative. But I'm afraid, looking closely at the pronouncements of our Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, that's probably one of the least likely things to happen.
Former Ambassador Richard Bronowski ending that report on the anniversary of the disclosure of Israel's nuclear weapons, 20 years ago yesterday. The time here on Worldview is 27 minutes to 7.
SBS Radio has a new service in Canberra on Canberra's 1440 AM. So from Monday, October 16, you'll hear SBS Radio's Worldview program in Canberra on 1440 on the AM band. Tune in to Worldview weekdays at 6 AM for the breakfast edition and in the afternoon from 5 o'clock. That's SBS Radio's Worldview program to be heard in Canberra on 1440 AM from Monday, October 16.
Has the page been turned in the brutal history of Northern Ireland? An independent international body monitoring the ceasefire has concluded that the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, is no longer engaged in paramilitary violence. It says the group has stopped recruiting members, stopped making bombs, and its leaders have taken a firm stand against members still engaged in criminal activities. While Tony Blair and Britain's Minister for Northern Ireland, Peter Haynes, are upbeat about the pronouncements, are those hopes shared by the people of Northern Ireland? Laura Hayden has been on the streets of Belfast to find out.
The International Monitoring Commission has reported that the IRA has radically transformed and that it has no intention of going back to violence. Does that make you feel optimistic for the future?
Yeah, well, I like to think so. We've had that much bother this past 30 years. Anything to make a happier life for all our children coming through and grandchildren, the better for Northern Ireland. There was peace and quiet on both sides.
Has this area of Belfast been at the sharp end of the violence over the years?
Yes, it has. It was pretty heavy in the 70s. A lot of bombings and casualties.
But many other people in this part of Belfast and in the Protestant community generally are sceptical both about the IMC report and about the IRA's intentions.
I wouldn't believe anything it said. Like, I wouldn't believe my own self, what they say, you know. I wouldn't trust the IRA, I wouldn't trust my own self. You know, they're both as bad as the other. Move to England or Scotland or somewhere out of
it. We don't have a great deal of faith in the IMC.
Why is that?
I just don't think that they do much.
You don't think they know what's really going on?
No.
I'm on the Falls Road in Catholic West Belfast. This is an area where the IRA has always had a very strong base.
The guns are silent. The guns are away, the guns are silent. The IRA's kept their nose clean. It's up to the loyalists on the other side now. They're still doing the punishments, still doing the beatings, still doing shooting. So, you know, it was always all blamed on the IRA. It was always the IRA this, the IRA that. What about the loyalists and unionists?
Even here, there's still some lingering doubts of whether the IRA has really gone away. But generally, there's optimism. What's your reaction? Does it make you optimistic for the immediate future, for the prospects of peace in the immediate future?
You kind of hope that there'll be less violence and less fighting and just less destruction in general and peace, hopefully. Please God.
I really don't think they have dismantled them completely. I'd say there's still, you know, a few that are just, yeah, small groups of them that will keep it up in their own private time. Or
do you feel any sense of optimism from this?
Oh yeah, definitely.
It makes me feel optimistic about the future, of course, but it's just the question remains whether the loyalists will disarm as well. If they disarm at the same time, then hopefully Northern Ireland will get somewhere. It's a big change. I mean, I think the last time anybody in the country felt like this was back about 1998, when President Clinton was over, during the whole ceasefire thing then. It really did, maybe it's because I was 18 at the time and I was younger, but it really did feel like something was changing.
Some of the views from the streets of Belfast in Northern Ireland. Well, a lecturer in Irish politics at London Metropolitan University, Jonathan Moore, also sees the research as the start of a new chapter in Northern Ireland. He's speaking with Lise Doucette.
This is yet another important change. The clean bill of health given to the IRA is very, very significant. It really is the end of a chapter. Even the most diehard unionists are not saying the IRA are going to come back. And the real question now is, how does the most important group on the unionist side, the Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionist Party, react to this? They are still saying there are other things that need to be done. But this is very major. Not only have they said that the IRA has pretty well dismantled itself, that the IMC report has said they're not involved in criminal activity. So that's very, very significant.
But they did say not everything has been done. They did say the command and control structure was still intact. Would there still be some, let us say, elements holding out?
Well, I mean, the big issue of Republican violence is now on dissident groups. And we don't know what they can do, but they're not linked to Sinn Féin. The command structure still exists, but it, in a sense, it exists in order to dismantle the IRA. What is interesting about this report, when I read it this afternoon, it's not saying that they were connected to any level of violence whatsoever. So that is very significant.
So then, if there is indeed a real shift on the part of the IRA, the ball is in the court of this largest partisan group, the pro-British party, the DUP. Do they really want to sit in the assembly that has been suspended for the past 4 years at Stormont?
They are split. Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionist Party is made up of two overlapping groups. One of them is a rural, utterly religious, very church-abiding group who find the idea of sitting down with any Republican, it would make them physically sick. The other side is made up of people who are hardline, but they're urban, they're more secular, they want a deal. The battle for that balance of power within a Democratic Unionist Party shifts from week to week. It is a party that is dominated by one man, the Reverend Ian Paisley. Ian Paisley has moved between the two sides. The fact that the party's been so successful electorally has been the result of him keeping both sides happy. He's now going to have to make a decision. Come the next month, mid-November, we've got this decision.
November 24th.
November the 24th. The they've got to make a decision. And it really is going to come down to them. The Belfast group, led by Peter Robinson, the deputy leader, desperately want a deal done. They're saying, we really want to hold power in Belfast. There are others who are saying, this is such an appalling deal. It means sitting down in government with former gunmen from the IRA. That's going to be the fascinating dispute. What one has to say is, this is going to make the decision more interesting, because it's actually saying the IRA appears to be clean at the moment.
Would they take a reading of public sentiment on both sides of the divide? And if so, what would it tell them?
Public opinion is very confused in Northern Ireland on this. There would be, I think, an equal divide. Within his own party, I think there were an awful lot of people who would actually say, no, you could never sit down with these people. But there are a lot of politicians in that party who quite like the trappings of power, who quite like the idea of holding ministerial office. So it's going to be a very close decision. I think what might help it is, I imagine, at the talks in Scotland next week, Sinn Féin is going to give its support to policing in Northern Ireland. That may be a deciding factor, but it's going to be a close call.
The BBC's Lise Doucette speaking with Irish politics lecturer Dr. Jonathan Moore. You're with Worldview and Adam Connors right across Australia. The time is 18 minutes to 7. How much do you know about Nepal and its culture, one of the world's poorest countries, sandwiched between India and China, and a country where they play elephant polo? The Himalayan Kingdom has been wracked by civil war since 1996, with Maoist rebels waging a campaign to overthrow the country's constitutional monarchy and set up a communist republic. Nepal has also had grassroots political protests and experimented with democracy, only to have the king suspend parliament several times. But two Nepalese teenagers were untouched by the country's politics when they independently decided a decade ago to come to Australia to study and to improve their prospects back home. Hemgale left West Nepal in 1996 to come to Melbourne, and Shab Mardin came from the other side of the country a year later. Theirs has been a story of discovery about their homeland, as well as a love story. They bring us this week's audio postcard.
My hometown is called Chitwan. I came to Australia to get a better future. Then I was going to go back home, but, you know, staying here.
I actually came from Tehran, which is the eastern part of Nepal that not many people know about, but it is one of the popular towns. And my intention to come here was basically to study, you know, just wanted to go overseas, get a bit of experience to see what's the other side of the world kind of thing.
Shabnam was 19 when she travelled to Australia and Hem was 17. Hem studied commercial cookery. Shabnam completed a degree in hospitality management before adding an accounting diploma to her bow.
I came here in 1997 and things were pretty much stable, I would say, but after 1997 things were getting a little, you know, hard with political region and everything. And my parents were like, you know, if you want to stay, you can, like, you know, if there is a way and if you can make a better future out there. It surprises me, actually, because it started in 1996 and I came here in 1997 and I had no clue about Maoist then, kind of. But after coming here, yeah, I learned more about Maoist.
So you weren't aware of it living back in Nepal before then. What do you understand about the Maoist rebellion?
I think the Maoists actually, their main, you know, people are actually came from remote villages, and I think it has to do with the poverty and because we have so many remote villages there where, you know, there is no like proper education or you know, electricity and all those general things that you want in your life.
Do the rebels have much support in Nepal from the general people?
They do, I think. They do, some percentages. Not everyone, I think, but...
So, Hem, yeah. you went back. When did you go back for a visit?
I went back several times, but first time I went was 99. Then that time wasn't too bad. It was all right. Then second time I went back, it wasn't too bad as well. But the third time, which is last year, it was really hard. Then I couldn't go to my hometown because of the Maoists. They strike all the street and there was wasn't any public transfer.
No
public transport at all. All the shop was closed and I couldn't go anywhere. Then I just came back from Kathmandu. Even though there's no plane, well, there was a plane, you know, but it's hard to get a ticket.
When we got the democracy, I think it was 1991, people were more happy and they thought there might be a, you know, another way, because things weren't, when we had the, we used to call Panchayati Bevastha, which is when our king used to rule over Nepal. But then there were a lot of things that people couldn't do at that time, like not to have your own religion, like because there are people out there with, you know, different religion, culture, tradition and everything. But at that time, before the democracy, the king would just have to have like one Hindu religion, and they even announced Nepal being the only country as a Hindu kingdom, things like that. But after the democracy, there were people coming out with, you know, different caste and different religion, culture, and it was just so much better. Like everyone looks happy, you know, freedom of speech and all that. So things were looking good. And then the king came back again, 1997. So,
which was the year that you decided to come to Australia.
Come to Australia. But that happened right after I came here. So I was a bit surprised. And personally, I wasn't very happy because people died to get the democracy. So many people died and all that. And that was just going in vain.
So what do young people these days want to do?
All the young people, they just want to go to overseas and earn the money, then send back to help the parents, you know.
And your own situation before you wanted to come out to Australia and do some study?
Yeah, I tried to join in the British Army, but most of the young people, they wanted to go to British Army.
Why is
and
that?
And probably, I guess, you got better future in...
Because the Gurkhas have a good reputation and
they
pay well?
Yeah, that is well. If you say Gurkhas in Nepal is really famous, you know, that's why you wanted to go in there. But you got to be really perfect to get in there. It's really hard to get in.
Now tell me about the connection between your father, Shabnam, and the Gurkhas.
My dad was with British Army in Second World War. They're like known as one of the bravest soldiers in the world. Nepal is actually a multicultural country. Like, we have I don't know the exact figure, but people with different religion, culture, caste, languages, and before the emperor, which is the Prithivinarayan Sa, the Sa dynasty, the pretty much the first king kind of thing. He actually took over all our, it used to be a little small kingdoms, like maybe 55 or something, and he took over all those kingdoms and actually made as one Nepal, and he did actually wanted to make Nepal, you know, Nepal as a Hindu kingdom. And later on, his great-grandson, King Mahendra, late King Mahendra, actually announced Nepal as a Hindu kingdom.
I understand Buddhism is one of the religions that's a national religion. How does that work, Hem?
We used to celebrate both festivals, you know, Hindus and Buddhism as well. But from now on, I think Buddhist people, they just started to celebrate their Buddhist festival.
So would some people call themselves both a Hindu and a Buddhist?
Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah, like, you know, here, they ask me, you know, then what religion are you? Then I'm just say to them, you know, I'm just half-half, you know, I'm in the middle.
And what do you say, Shabnam?
Yeah, a bit of everything. But, yeah, it's one thing good about Nepal is, though, as I said, you know, there's all these different religions now. People do live in harmony and we do respect each other's religion and we do celebrate all these different festivals that we have.
And you have one national language.
Yes, which is Nepalese. It's
Nepalese, yeah. But you also have your own dialects.
Yeah, even though I'm from far away, even we got different languages. Different castes speak different language. See, myself, is my surname is Gale, then we speak different language than Shabnams. And different castes, then they speak different languages.
How important is the caste system in today's Nepal?
Still, people, you know, do actually believe that they should have their own dialect, like languages. You know, they want their children to speak their own language, and you know, actually, with even getting married and all that, they want their people to get married to their own caste. So, but things are getting a little easier now. Things are not as hard as it used to be. People are getting more educated, and yeah.
Now, I want to know about the story about how you met. So tell me, how did you come across each other? Because you didn't meet in Nepal, you met in Melbourne.
When we first came here, there weren't that many Nepalese, and we used to know, you know, like every Nepalese that actually live in Melbourne. So we actually met through a friend's circle. So we used to see each other now and then. We were friends before,
Now tell me, Hem, though, because I was asking you before about the caste system.
Yeah.
Are your parents happy that you married Shabnam?
No, they're still not happy.
Why?
Because he's from different caste. They want me to marry with my own caste. She's got different religion and different caste. She speaks different language. Before, it used to be like the parents used to choose the woman for you, you know. It's like a sort of arranged marriage then, but nowadays, like, even the parents choose the woman for you, then you go and, you know, you chat with them, because it's been like so many divorce cases happening. That's why they have to eat like each other.
Even though your parents aren't happy?
Yeah.
Does that worry you? Does that concern you that they're not happy?
It does, used to, but
they're coming with the terms of us being married. I think they don't have choice, do they?
They don't
parents,
have a choice.
You
yeah,
know, they do get upset in the beginning.
It's my life, though, actually, you know, it's just because they don't have to do anything about it. You know, just.
And together you run a restaurant now in suburban Melbourne.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of hard work, actually, and long hours, yeah, but it's good, actually. We have a lot of good, you know, clients, customers, regular customers, and just nice, actually, you know, just to actually serve Nepalese food there.
How is Nepalese food different from Indian food? What are the differences in spices?
Our curries are lighter than the Indians. Then we got noodles, stir fries, different like bit of Asian mix and the Indian sort of things.
I would say as in spices with the Indian food, I think you taste more of the spice than the food. But in Nepalese, you can still taste the food. And we put like fresh ingredients, I would say, like garlic, ginger. I think Indian, they use more the cumin seeds and all the other herbs and spices. But we do use all of those too, but just a little less amount, I would say.
Going back to Nepal, what are the major issues that you understand, you know, the biggest problems that Nepal has today?
I have to say, I think poverty, it's just creating everything, I guess, and education and getting the, you know, right education to the right place, as I said, remote villages. And I think we, well, sometimes I do think people like us should actually go back, and, you know, maybe that would make a lot of difference, like going back and helping, you know, all the other unfortunate people out there.
I think it's a very important announcement indeed. The Maoists declared a similar ceasefire last September for 3 months, which was then extended by 1 month. The king has said that he's retreating from royal absolute rule, parliament is to be restored, and that there's to be an all-party government, which should be in place as early as today, before parliament comes back tomorrow. And
do you think democracy will ever have a chance?
Definitely, yes, yeah. I do believe in that.
Because King Gyanendra ended direct rule again in April this year and is talking to the rebels, but what is the situation? Who's running the country at the moment?
There's a prime minister now, which is the ex-prime minister, became, I think it's fourth or fifth time became a prime minister. I think he's the one who is making the decision now.
Democratically elected?
Yes. From Congress Party, yeah. Prasad Kerala.
What's your feeling about with the rebels? I mean, will they ever come to an agreement so that the rebels stop the insurgency?
I hope they do come in a term, and the king should, I think, in my opinion, the king should step down and let the democratic people of in the politicians and the people should handle, I think. Because even the king has actually taken the power before, and we didn't see much outcome of it.
Are the Maoist rebels able to be a part of a political party that can be in the parliament or not? They're outside?
At the moment, I think still outside, from my understanding. But I think it would be good, I think, if the rebels, the Maoist and the Democratic Party of Nepal would come together and bring a solution to the country, and hopefully there is still a future.
Do you both think you'll go back one day and live in Nepal?
Yeah, we thought about it, going back home and live there in our retired life. If the situation, although, you know, if the country get better, then we thought we might going to go, because we got a better future. I mean, when you get older, it's better future back home, you know. Because here it's like your kids won't look after you.
It depends how you bring them up. Doesn't it?
But they do, I mean, you know. Even though you grow up really nicely, even then, they don't really stay with you. You know, when you're older, then, you know, you got to do your own shopping, this and that. But if you're in Nepal, then the kids will... Well,
not
I'm
really
hoping,
nowadays,
but I don't think...
Because parents are alone in Nepal. Yeah.
All the best.
Thank you.
Shabnam Mardin and Hem Gale, proprietors of the Kathmandu Kitchen Restaurant in suburban Melbourne, with today's audio postcard from Nepal. And that was produced by Caroline Davey.
G'day, George Negus. Whether it's politics or global trends, economics or the environment, Dateline's got it covered. A team of reporters offers you a window to the world with award-winning international current affairs. So join us each Wednesday night at 8:30 for Dateline on SBS TV.
And it's approaching 3 minutes to seven here on SBS Radio. And before we go, a final check of today's main stories. NATO's operation in Afghanistan has become the biggest in the organisation's history, with 32,000 troops as it assumes command of the eastern provinces of Afghanistan. The region was under the control of United States military commanders since the overthrow of the Taliban 5 years ago. Australia says Papua New Guinean authorities should arrest Australian lawyer Julian Moti, who is wanted in Australia on a child sex charge. PNG's Prime Minister Michael Somare says he does not believe PNG authorities have any obligation to arrest Mr. Moti, but Australia's Justice Minister Chris Ellison disagrees. The Democrats have condemned the federal government's stated intention to appeal a federal court decision granting native title over about 6,000 square kilometres of metropolitan Perth and its surrounds. Federal Attorney General Philip Ruddock claims the federal court's decision could mean that people who aren't the traditional owners could be denied access to public open spaces, including parks and beaches. The Parliamentary Secretary for Immigration, Andrew Robb, says the introduction of a formal citizenship test will not result in fewer employment opportunities for people with poor English language skills. Ethnic and community groups are critical of the proposal. However, Mr. Robb says acquiring English language skills will not be a part of the criteria for getting a job in Australia. The United States negotiator to stalled six-party talks with North Korea has warned against any nuclear test. North Korea says it plans to test a nuclear device at an unspecified date in response to what it describes as a threat of nuclear war and sanctions from the US. And finally, a critically wounded schoolgirl injured in Monday's shooting at an Amish school in the United States has been taken off life support and taken home to die. Five girls were killed when Charles Roberts besieged their school, lined them up and shot them before turning the gun on himself. And the weather across Australia for today. In Adelaide, it's going to be fine and sunny and 22. In Brisbane, mostly fine, 27. In Canberra, fine and sunny, 22. In Darwin, fine and sunny and 35. In Hobart, mainly fine and 18. In Melbourne, fineness continues. It's going to be mostly sunny and 20. And in Perth, fine and 24. And in Sydney, fine and lengthy sunny periods and 22. That's Worldview for this morning and the week from myself, Adam Connors. Join us again at 5 p.m. for the afternoon edition of Worldview with Caroline Davey. And we'll be back again on Monday morning at 6 with more insights into cross-cultural Australia right here on SBS National Radio. Meanwhile, have a great weekend.